All right, begin. Welcome, everybody. Tonight's class is called The Perils of Jewish Success. And we're gonna take it to contemporary, literally, as the events are unfolding on a daily basis on the whole Ukraine affair and impeachment issue. We're getting into that. I'm going to focus on the Jewish angle of this. We're going to get into the Jewish angle on this. You'll not work. No, look, I got your attention there. Steve on, look at that. All right. That's it. You didn't think there was anything. Okay, so let's. So, for those who are not fully up to date, this is sort of like a primer video of like the basics. So, we'll do this. All right. And then I'll update this from a month ago, but it's the basic here. Let's go to the. Scott, let's turn off the light and then shit the movie time. Here we go.
My question, did you ever speak to the president about this complaint?
Congress is investigating allegations that President Trump pushed a foreign government to dig up dirt on his Democratic rivals.
It's just a Democrat witch hunt. Here we go again.
At the heart of an impeachment inquiry is a 9-page whistleblower complaint that names over 24 people. Not counting the president himself, these are the people that appear the most. First, Trump's personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. According to documents and interviews, Giuliani has been involved in shadowy diplomacy on behalf of the president's interests. He encouraged Ukrainian officials to investigate the Biden family's activities in the country, plus other avenues that could benefit Trump, like whether the Ukrainians intentionally helped Democrats during the 2016 election. It was an agenda he also pushed on TV.
And so you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden.
Of course I did.
A person Giuliani worked with? Yuri Lutsenko. Ukraine's former prosecutor general. He pushed for investigations that would also benefit Giuliani and Trump. Lutsenko also discussed conspiracy theories about the Bidens in the U.S. media, but he later walked back his allegations, saying there was no evidence of wrongdoing by the Bidens. This is where Hunter Biden comes in, the former vice president's son. He served on the board of a Ukrainian energy company, run by this guy, who's had some issues with the law. While Biden was in office, he, along with others, called for the dismissal of Lutsenko's predecessor, a prosecutor named Viktor Shokin, whose office was overseeing investigations into the company that Hunter Biden was involved with. Shokin was later voted out by the Ukrainian government. Lutsenko replaced him, but was widely criticized for corruption himself. When a new president took office in May, Volodymyr Zelensky said that he'd replace Lutsenko. Giuliani and Trump, not happy. They viewed Lutsenko as their ally. During the July 25th call between Trump and the new Ukrainian president, Trump defended him, saying, I heard you had a prosecutor who was very good, and he was shut down, and that's really unfair. Trump also allegedly asked his counterpart to continue the investigation into Joe Biden, who is his main rival in the 2020 election. Zelensky has publicly denied feeling pressured by Trump.
No, it's no pressure.
And then finally, Attorney General William Barr, who also came up in the July 25th call. In a reconstructed transcript, Trump repeatedly suggested that Zelensky's administration could work with Barr and Giuliani to investigate the Bidens and other matters of political interest to Trump. Since the whistleblower complaint was made public, Democrats have criticized Barr for dismissing allegations that Trump had violated campaign finance laws during his call with Zelensky and not passing along the complaint to Congress. House Democrats have now subpoenaed several people mentioned in the complaint as an impeachment inquiry into the president's conduct continues.
Okay, the plug back on. Got you in the plug on. All right, so since that's half a month ago, a lot has happened. So there's one curious little fact, which is Ukraine new president Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yes.
Jew.
A
Jew. A Jewish comedian, actually, who shockingly got the job as being the president of Ukraine. Okay. Who's in charge of leading the campaign internally, managing the campaign internally for Donald Trump as far as the impeachment? Who's the chief strategist or the quarterback? That's it, Jared Kushner, modern Orthodox Jew. We continue on. two people that were arrested when they had a one-way ticket back to the Ukraine, Mr. Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, what are they accused of doing?
Well, they were working with Rudy Giuliani.
Working
with a lot of money to, like, their
campaign
or something?
Yeah, there's money. And basically their job was to get dirt on behalf of Donald Trump's camp, you know, 2020 campaign. Okay? Caught. Okay. And both those guys? Jewish.
No.
I didn't know they were.
Jewish. Jewish. Wikipedia. All right, we're building on a minion here, guys. We're going a full minion here. All right, Representative Congressperson Adam Schiff, that congressman who is taking personal mission to investigate Trump's connection to Russia, separate from the investigation by the special counsel. Jewish,
unfortunately,
way Jewish. Yes, from our own neighborhood here for the Upper West Side, ladies and gentlemen, Representative Jerry Nadler. Jewy McJew, okay, all right, super Jew, all right, okay, also part of the House Judiciary Committee, also part of the investigation. Then we continue on, Elliot Engel, congressperson, from the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, also a Jew, Elliot Engel, come on, all right. Then we had 2 weeks ago, testimony by a decorated soldier, Alexander Vindman, not in the favor of Donald Trump. No, not good. Jewish. Okay, so we got a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We're at 8 Jews. We're too short of a minion, and there are more. There are more that are not, you know, but those are the main people, okay? Okay. Quinkadink. We'll get into that. So we're going to start off. I'm going to, as a framing principle, I'm not going to get into the merits or non-merits of the impeachment appeal. That's not my expertise. I have an opinion like everybody else. But I'm interested in about is the Jewish angle on this, which you will not hear about. But I'm sure we'll get into it tonight. Okay, so we're going to frame it from a the last Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Shemaiah and Avtalion, who were the part of the Masorah, main chief of the Masorah, receive in all tradition. Shemaiah would say, love malacha, love work, love, you know, person of job. Hate acting the superior, hate taking positions of authority, unless you can avoid that. We discussed that in many other classes. Or you only take it the position of authority. If you don't do it, nobody else will. Or it'll be done in an inferior fashion. It's the only time you take a position of authority. And there's reasons for that. But now that's not our focus for tonight. And lastly, do not attempt to draw near the ruling authority. Or avoid being in the ruling authority. Okay, so we're going to get into that. We're going to get into that whole thing. But it's more complicated. All right, question number one. Why would someone not love malacha? How else is one to get one's needs? What are other ways to get your needs if you don't like to work?
Get other people to pay for you.
Or get other people to work for you. Or, basically use others, either their resources or efforts to cash in on. Or steal. Right, steal. Stealing is also an option. All right, you don't want to work, so there's an whole underground economy of people who support themselves via theft. Okay, whether it be organized or not organized, these are criminals. Okay, so number two, how is being a superior, having a position of power, a strategy for avoiding the indignity of malacha, of work? How is by being the boss, I think everybody's felt it often, even today, maybe at the job, how is being the superior strategy for avoiding the indignity of malacha? Right, so all the things that you don't like to do, you have your underlings do your quote-unquote your dirty work for them, right? So you want to be in a position of authority, so then you can cherry pick what you want to do, and the things that you view as beneath your personal dignity, you get others to do. Sounds like a good job. It's good to be the king. Okay? As the phrase goes. Well, I'm just warming you guys up here tonight. It's already warm already. All right, question number three. How is drawing near the authority a strategy for avoiding lonely malacha? Right. So if you are buddy buddy with the government, you know, with political leaders, how does that help you avoid, if your quest is to not do malacha or do the least amount possible, how is it helpful for your personal mission?
You get connections and appointments and no-show jobs.
Yes. If you are part of the ruling class, you will get either, you know, just appointments that are basically nothing. You don't have to do it. You don't have to really exert yourself. Or you can get to do work which is, you know, that you find is superior work, maybe, which is even beyond your quote-unquote official pay grade. So that's a strategy to be suck up with the ruling class to avoid having to work, you know, undignified kind of labor, which you perceive as such.
Well, it goes the other way. It also works the way too that there's like this long tradition of the court Jew that also.
We're going to get to the court Jew. The focus we're going to give, that is our focus for tonight, is the court Jew.
Okay.
We're getting into that.
Because it also.
He's the first one. We're getting there. We're getting there. You guys, we're getting there. Okay. Good. We're going deeper, but I'm warming everybody up here. You know, I'm throwing off the lobs with the softball. Okay. Why is drawing near a non-Jewish authority such as Paro or Donald Trump even more perilous than doing so with a Jew?
So when I read this question, I felt we're making the assumption that Jewish leader would be more
meritorious. I'm saying, why may it be more perilous?
There's been arguing that we have different ethos and ethics as a Jewish person. Also, a lot of Jews in the workplace, because I work with a lot of them, are super secular and have don't follow.
Okay. I understand that.
But how many Israeli presidents and prime ministers in jail?
So I'm not. I didn't take out the word perilous. I just said more perilous. Why is if you're working for Paro or you're working for Donald Trump, why might it be more perilous? Okay, that's one factor.
Michael Cohen, Cohen.
Because you don't know, when you crack that open, right? You don't know whether that guy is ever going to be totally good for the Jews. You never know. You never know.
Well, you should have the opposite assumption.
Well, no, but I'm saying the tendency is to buddy up and think, oh, he's the best ever.
If you go back to Michael Cohen's, testimony when he got busted, was that he thought, you know, he was having a bromance with Donald Trump. And then Donald Trump basically didn't need him anymore, or he was a liability, and cast him away, and he's going to jail, and Donald Trump is yet not going to jail. So that's the deal. But not to mention, they can ask you to do stuff which is immoral. In other words, the ruling class has to have people working around them to do stuff which is, first of all, that they need a distance from immoral, illegal activities, and therefore you can be forced to doing a compromise your integrity. Now, going back to Simone's point, you look at the Israeli government. Right now, we have Prime Minister Netanyahu. Will he be indicted for the 3 counts of fraud and other malfeasance? That's it. If you go, through the Tanakh, because by definition, if you are in a position of, that's another reason not to have a position of leadership, because it is intrinsically corrupting. It's very hard to be an ethical person when you are the boss, when you have access to all the resources or a tremendous amount. and take advantage of that authority. Right? I mean, you have Ahasuerus and you have Bill Clinton, you know. Ahasuerus is able to just demand all the virgins for himself, you know, the entire empire. Bill Clinton had to do was a little more, had to be a little more discreet, but should have been a little more discreet. Missed that one. I'm referring to the Lewinsky affair. Google that one, you know, I remember that. Also Jewish. Yes. Right. That wasn't the mitzvah she was looking for. Anyways, so that's the challenge here. What strategy of leaders such as Trump is Pirkei Avos mindful of? Let's go from the other thing. What is Donald Trump or all leaders with their circle of people? If the Pirkei says avoid it, so obviously there's an attraction toward what we just identified, so I can get plum, not hardworking jobs or jobs which have a tremendous amount of avod, right? Whether it be Obama or Trump, all leaders, not really, they're very mindful of this, and how do they utilize that for their advantage?
Who? Sorry.
The authorities. Obama, Trump, everybody.
They pit their court view against the other group.
Well, they're not only do they court you, but really everybody in their sphere. Basically, they're making a fundamental deal. What's the deal? There's an unspoken deal, guys. What? Well, that's if something goes really bad. But initially, is you will do my work, whatever it is, and you will get tremendous kavod. You're part of the administration. Now, you have to ask the question: why is Donald Trump seems to be firing somebody every day? I don't know if you, but there seems to be, once he fires somebody, there's another guy taking the place. Like, hello, your longevity, you're going to have a short shelf life here, but yet there's somebody there. So the kavod of being a part of the administration, being part of the insider group is so toxic, either because you're going to be an insider, you'd be able to do some deals of things that will not become known to us in 5 or 10 years, or maybe earlier, or B, or just the authority that you're a big macher. In other words, trading kavod to have them do all the hard work. Who in Tanakh is quintessentially that guy? There's more than one answer. They had to work very hard, but part of the deal with the ruler. Yosef. We'll get to him, but who else? He had to work for Lavan. Yeah, he had to deal with a lot of he got abused in that relationship.
Daniel,
well, he was also court Jew. He didn't have a chance. He was like both of them. They had no choice. They were put into that position.
Yeah.
But
Mordecai,
also Haman. Uh-huh. Even though we don't look at Haman as a favorable guy, basically had to run in other words, Ahasuerus gave him tremendous kavod as a deal. And I'll bow down to you. Meanwhile, he can sit back in his palace there with all his nashim, with all his women, and this guy schwitz running the empire.
Yeah. You've got Pope Polkaros too, who does Joseph serve in the house of? Is he like the chief of staff for Pharaoh?
So the Sar HaMashkim, Potiphar, right? But everybody who works in Paro's camp is doing. That's a deal. Well, first of all, and if you say no, you will get killed. So it's an additional, in the ancient world, there was, you had an additional motivation. Like, if he asks you to do that, there is basically only one app. I'll be there. Seems like I'll be there. Okay. All right. Well, we keep on going. 7, what was Joseph's Goshen plan limiting the pursuit of high office in Egypt? Why didn't Joseph's Goshen plan work out? Okay. Those who were in fellowships, senior fellowship in the past, we discussed this in a last year or a year or two ago, I don't remember exactly. What was, when the brothers came down, what was Yosef's Goshen plan?
That they should stay there where the grass is greener and they wouldn't be too involved in the political.
Yeah, he told them to say what? What did Yosef gave them their talking point? There were 5 guys went into Paro. And what did he tell them? We're shepherds. Our fathers are shepherds. We only know shepherding. Because what's Paro thinking when Yosef's 11 brothers are coming to town. What is he thinking? I got 11 Yosefs. We're going to take over the world. It's going to be awesome. You see, this guy is awesome. Imagine 11 more of these guys. So he told them, we're shepherds. We all know shepherds. Shepherds. Grass. And even Paro then, what did he cop? Because the ruler always, whatever available possible resource, he always grabs. What did he cop as they were walking out? And good, you'll watch my sheep, my cotton herds. Great, you'll run after my flock. He still got them to do his herds. Now you're in charge of his herds. Always, you're not walking out. He's always getting. He's a taker, not a giver. Sometimes he gives to Norris, you know, the line goes, the best time to give is before you take. He just takes. He's, all right, you got that? All right, I'm referring to the Adam Grant book, Givers and Takers. Check that, read that book out. Okay.
Goshen
is the sort of the, it's a rich area near the Nile Delta, which had a lot of grass. And that's where, and away from the capital. You're in the sticks. You're in the hinterlands. You're in the farming community. You're not even in the suburbs. You're like, you're okay. So did Yosef's plan work? Did it work or not work?
No.
Well, it did. It was almost super effective in that the Jews had no political power in Egypt. The other kings came, right? They came completely
enslaved. Okay, so you're right. So there was a downside, but also, well, no. Initially, it worked. They were out in the sticks, and then what happened to the Jewish people in the subsequent generations? They had tons of kids, and they could not fit in Goshen anymore. So they had to move to the cities. Okay, we're gonna get to that. We're gonna circle back by the end of the class to that. Okay, all right. Question number 8: Does Yosef's laying low approach to anti-Semitism mean that no one should assume high office? Did Yosef himself have a high office?
Yeah.
So how is that, should nobody have a high office? Should nobody be a court Jew?
My parents talked about this a little bit growing up, that their parents would say, like, we start first having Jews run for office in America, people like, we have a good, why are we trying to make a ruckus now?
Really? Right. Well, that's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
That's an old tradition. Well, that's from Birkei Avos.
But
my question is, but you see that Yosef himself, we just mentioned Yosef and Daniel and Mordechai and a lot of, and going further, Don Isaac of Abarbanel. A lot of Jews were brought in into the king's court, to the ruling. So how do you figure that out?
Isn't there something that says, like, because this was the thing with the judges too, and Gideon, is that like he didn't take power when he should have, and then so someone less qualified and brought more evil to it. So it's like, if you don't take the job, it's going to be worse off than if you do take the job.
Correct. So, Jewish leaders have, this is, there's no answer to this. It's a judgment call in every circumstance. It's sort of like one of the somewhat tragedies of, like, for example, in the Rambam's life, Maimonides' life, he was the great Torah scholar, also the best physician in Egypt. So who did he serve? Well, there's no power at that point. The Sultan. This is during the Islamic age. So the Sultan had to travel every single day as a doctor, every day to check on the Sultan. Not like a 6-month checkup. He was there every day. And not only him, but dealing with his concubines. So here's one of the greatest minds in the last 2,000 years dealing with these girls with sexual transmitted diseases, whatever, because what God knows what's going on there, right? And this is what he writes to his students, don't come and visit me because I have no time. because he talked about his schedule. You should read it. I'll send you guys.
Yes, please.
And basically, all day he's with the Sultan and the court and all their needs. He comes back exhausted. He eats one orange just to get himself back. And then he has a line out the door of Jews and non-Jews that want his medical help. And basically, he's at the point where he's like prescribing horizontally because he has simply no energy. The only time he has time to learn, he said, is Shabbos. He's down to a Shabbos only. I mean, this is, do you understand what the Rambam could accomplish in learning in 1 hour? I mean, just the guy who produced the Mishnah Torah, I mean, just, he did it before this. So why did he do it? I turned it back. Why did he do it? Why did he spend his time dealing with the Sultan of Egypt? What? No, he could have to make a living elsewhere. He could be a physician to other people, not just the Sultan. He could be a doctor, but he doesn't have to be a doctor and working with the Sultan. What's the thing about the Sultan?
He must have made the decision it would have been better for him to be the doctor. Doctor.
Why? What's motivating him? Protecting the Jews. This is, he ran from Spain because the Almohads, the fanatical Shiite Muslims, sounds familiar, came into Spain and was forced converting the Jews. So this was a relatively benign dictator. You only had two kinds of dictators in the ancient world. You had benign dictators and a superly aggressive dictator. Those are your choices. You don't have like, let me go for any options for a Jeffersonian democracy. No, that's not going to be thought of for another 700 years. Okay? You just have basically, and they can do the hell you want. And you're a Jew, you're less, you're a dhimmi in the Islamic world. You're nothing. You're a second class, third class person. So he did it because if he didn't do it, that gives him influence to make sure the Jews aren't slaughtered. It could be like it's going to be a massacre tomorrow. There's nothing you can do about it. Other than run. How fast can you run? The sword. That's the world. So if he didn't do that, the Jews could be killed. So that's why he did it. He had to sacrifice basically the rest of his life, professionally and, physically, just ensure that the Jews were able to survive. So you had to work with the leader, because the consequence of not dealing with them is horrendous. Okay. Let's move it up to our this last century. During World War II, the American Jewish community took a timid approach in dealing with President Franklin Roosevelt. That was the mentality that Max mentioned. In pushing him to deal with immigration and bombing the concentration camps, those efforts failed, as we tragically know. What lesson did we learn? How many protests were there in front of the White House because of the Holocaust? One. The rabbis, Erev Yom Kippur, 1942. It was well known already that that the Nazis were already liquidating the Jews. The news got out from Europe that there was the final solution, which we're going to go to next week. We're going to some of the WANSI conference.
Did they have, surveillance quotas?
Yeah, they had immigration quotas. You couldn't get in. So they were saying, well, let them in. They're going to get killed. And they're concentrated. Bomb the rails. So their a book came out, While 6 Million Die, where it came out, where fact that the State Department were basically anti-Semitic. They didn't follow them much. And they basically said, he wouldn't meet with them, and he told them through a party that, we're doing the best we can. The goal is to defeat Germany, and that'll end it, which it will. But while you're doing that, a couple of bombs at Bergen and Belsen and Auschwitz and Dachau could have saved a million Jews. Didn't care.
Stephen S. Wise acted as an important Jew.
Right.
Tell the other Jews.
Down. Keep it down. In other words, he took don't make a ruckus. While Peter,
in the Madison Square Garden.
Yes. So there's one guy who's a relative of Rav Kook, I think his nephew. Peter Bergson. And he created a whole, and he said, we're gonna break the law. We're gonna get Jews out, we're gonna do a dam. And we're not dealing with this timid American Jewish establishment. So from that whole era led to a much more really AIPAC is a consequence of that failed effort. In other words, and before that was really the movement, the Soviet Jewry movement of protesting. Rabbi Wild and I, 1986, were in front of the famous 86 was 87 of the big million person protest in Washington D.C. Back in the day. So the question is, question number 10, how do we reconcile the lessons of World War II with Pirkei Avos? How do you work that out? On one hand says, don't become close to the king. On the other hand, when you're not close, people die. What principle to work? How do you have what they say, the Pasuk HaShlishi Sherach Yivinim, the third verse that does to resolve the two contradictory verses? On one hand says, do not get close to the king. On the other hand, you don't, if you're not able to, you're not close, and you have a relationship now, big deal. Now, by the way, there's an interesting halacha that people who are karav l'malkut, people whose job as to be a court Jew, are allowed to violate certain prohibitions, to wear non-Jewish clothing, they had unique non-Jewish clothing, which is of idolatry. Yet you're allowed to wear Christian garb. Okay, so this interesting, how that is the whole conversation going. But we're saying there's an idea called karav l'malkut. There's a whole discussion, like when there's a whole controversy, bringing it to, you know, when President Obama was inaugurated and he had the prayer service in the national, cathedral. Thank you. So there was an ask. Rabbi Haskell Lookstein was asked to represent the Orthodox community. Now it's a prohibition of going to a church. So he went and he argued that he's a karav l'malkut and therefore the dispensation would apply in his case. But it was a whole big thing. But just giving you a sense, because if I'm not there, and when, you know, you can't be there when there's a crisis, you got to be there and be pro. And, you know, this is when, if you go back when Barack Obama said, when he visited Sderot, if my daughter was being bombed, I would do whatever I can to stop the bombing. Remember that quote? So he said, so Rabbi Lookstein told Barack, President Obama, remember Sderot, you know, basically to advocate, you know, for Israel. So you got to be, you know, if you're not there for them at their big moment, they're not going to be there for you. You're not there for them, they will not be there for you.
How do you decide who is the right person to do that?
Okay, good. All right, so go ahead.
That's
part of the same thing. How do you reconcile these two things? On one hand, you know, we identified if you're going to get close to the thing, you might get sucked in and pulled under, like Henry Kissinger, who was a court Jew to Richard Nixon, who basically fundamentally worked out his entire foreign policy, was not in favor of helping the Jews in 1973. President Nixon, Zohar Latov, said, "You fly out everything we have." He saved the state of Israel in 1973. That major airlift because they run. The problem is that Israel, you know, you're running a war. You go through munitions, and that would have been it. If it wasn't for the American airlift, game over. So he, you know, and he overruled Kissinger, the Jew. Yes.
Okay. So in the example, it doesn't say like you're clear of authority. It says really love Malacha and hate acting as superior. So maybe it's all about intention. Joseph has an employee to decision, Kinesa has an employee, the Rambam is doing for his team. So it's not so much like take honor for the sake of honor like some of these other things are doing. Very painful for anyone. I mean, especially if you have been with your brothers and sisters in Israel and Europe, suffering. But it's like a sort of necessary evil, but it's not like we should love the fact that you have a position of authority, you should appreciate because you can do good,
Yeah, I think what you're saying, I think, tell me if I'm, I'll say it back, you know, is, in other words, do not view it as a good. It only has instrumental value if I can therefore be there for the Jewish people. So I will join the authority because I happen to be uniquely positioned to help out.
And now, does this count if you're like a tested member of Israel as well, as just if you're a foreign government? Because you can do things that are harmful to you. It's probably not as black and white, it's more complicated.
Well, the second thing is not, is to, in other words, a person should not want to be a Knesset member. I understand that. So therefore, if that's a person who was uniquely gifted to do that, a person should only do that role begrudgingly. In other words, the problem is that it's intoxicating. Because power is intoxicating. Okay?
And someone can aspire to be like the prime minister?
No. That guy's intrinsically,
president or
that's intrinsically disqualification of the person.
See, but how do you get like a Moses?
Yeah, that's exactly. No, that's exactly it. That's a proof. Moshe did not want it.
Yeah, but you can't do that. You need a functioning government in Israel.
I understand that. I understand. So therefore, the thing is, if the person, I mean, I'm saying in a true, well, that's why we get the government we have. That's the answer. Yeah, you get what you get. But the ideal, what we're talking about here, is that a person is not not part of their identity until they want to be rule over people. They're not yet to be the big mocker. They want to be at the flashy red carpet affair. They want to be in the shadows, but they do it because they have to be uniquely positioned. They got to do it. Because if I don't do it, if there's no Jewish influence, first of all, we mentioned eight people. I'm not even mentioning Jason Greenblatt, I'm not being David Friedman, all Orthodox guys who are also very close in the entire Trump circle.
I have a question about David. I mean, this seems to be the antithesis of everything. He's so charismatic and he was
great.
And, he
had like a
quality
sort of
like
thing.
Yes, he
did.
And he kind of
was
chosen. He
also wanted it. He never wanted it. He was like watching the sheep, and then Samuel the prophet came, and Yishai, Jesse, the father, thought he was going to go to his older sons, not his little pitzel son, this little guy, and he makes him easy Melch Yisrael. It's like he had no aspiration to be the Melch Yisrael. And then it was not going to be a clean transition, because it wasn't like, and then by the way, Shmuel didn't go to Shmuel told Shaul, King Saul, it's going to be over, but he didn't say, and I want your resignation papers. There was a 7 years of bloody transition. He nearly got killed.
Well, once he became king, though, he enjoyed it. I mean, he had property by his wives, his house, wealth. I mean, it was like he played the part well. It wasn't like he was an unwilling king the entire time. He started off that way.
Well, for 7 years, he was a fugitive of the state. And then for the 33 years, I mean, one of the reasons of not wanting for leadership is basically it buries the people out of that position. The stress of being in charge, you think it's great, it's horrible. Because you're responsible for everybody. There's no end to the headaches. It looks cool. Horrible. Horrible. Okay, we continue going on. Now we go on to today. President Trump says the Jews who oppose him are ungrateful and disloyal. In the summertime, I don't know if you remember that. What do you think the Republican street is saying about Nadler, Schiff, which she named Little Shifty Schiff, and Engel being so visible in the impeachment effort of President Trump? What do you think they're saying?
I mean, there's no way to win anyway because there's Jews on all sides and doing all kinds of things. Effectives, I think.
Okay, but do you think that? I mean, again, we're in the speculation part of the class here. I mean, after if President Trump goes down and he was basically deposed by a wall of Jewish Democrats. Is that going to go, is that historically, is that, does that go well for Jews?
No, but there are Jews in all sides. Like there's
okay.
Jews on the Republican side as
right.
well. So basically, anyway.
What are they going to say about the Nadler shift in England? What are the historic anti-Semitic tropes that are always verbalized? Already it was verbalized when Trump called Schiff little shifty Schiff. Shifty is not, it goes into what quality of the Jew are they, anti-Semitic quality of the Jew is being identified? Sneaky, clever, tricky, not honorable, backstabbing, you know, Shylock. Think of all the negative associations. Thank you. I got the Shylock down. Okay. Okay.
All right.
We continue. All right. Now let's. Now I want to take. I want to before we get into the actual the. All right. Just very briefly, just to make it practical, this situation applies to every one of us. All of us have bosses. So the question, even on, you know, as you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Does Pirkei Avos agree with that? Sometimes, maybe. Right. So in that case, that's a good thing. So therefore, obviously, networking and getting connections and clients is good. But is there ever too much networking or too much honing of skills? What's the downside of it? Is there ever too much?
I think you can argue the way it becomes like a form of idolatry.
Okay.
Right.
In what sense?
That you're just no longer pursuing. No longer pursue Hashem. Instead, you're become concerned of material things, right? Money and honor and respect and authority, things of this world.
Just about buffing and uplifting your brand.
What if you love your malacha, your profession, and you want to do the work? But you have to. It's a necessary evil.
So that's the exact point. To not network and to not improve your skills, you're an idiot. Okay? If in a compulsive fashion, it becomes the good of life itself, that's an evil. So there's a sweet spot. So if your boss is calling a retreat and it's not 100% optional, what are you doing? You gotta go. You are going to the retreat, and you gotta smile. All right, but then there's the obsequious tuchus kissing excess that often might go backfire, but is not right. Is not the.
The Rambam says that we always have to be in the middle.
Correct. That's well said. So there's now what the exact principle is that. It's what I need, which is instrumental, and gets to question number six, is success measured in job title and salary alone, or other factors to consider? Stress and corruption. In other words, yeah, I might get that additional job, but what is that job? What's the real cost? Everything has a cost. You always pay. The currency changes. You're always paying in life. The currency changes. Oh, you might have a bigger thing, but now you have to manage people. You're now there. You're in the office. Endlessly, sorrows say you that break your head apart. You now have to like spend your whole and is this the problems that I want to spend my life solving? Is it worth it? Oh yeah, so I got X more dollars and I have this little position and I got the corner office, but it's all it is. Like I want to open the window and step out. You know what I mean? So I was like what am I really? Did I gain or did I lose? You thought I gained, right? Where the promotion could be really a demotion in your personal life. Okay, we continue on. Okay, right, so that same question, how much energy should I put into honing my craft skills for editing? Well said, it's the golden mean. Okay, now let's get into some of the foolish part. Let's have someone read, Brace 4727, would like to read, raise your hand. Daphne, you've been selected. All right, so this is when the Jew, so Yosef resettles the entire 70 people of Jewish people. They're in Goshen, and not only that, they start to get holdings in it, and they're starting to become abundant. Very wild medrash. All right, go ahead. Let me have Anna read the midrash.
The land grabs them and held on to them. If they want to leave before this time, they would not be able to, like a man withheld without.
So what does that mean? So in other words, the Yechazu means and they acquired it, but it's a play on who's it? The land acquired them. In other words, they came to be there for a short time, and they came into the situation and they got stuck, pulled under.
Is this every Jew in exile now? Like I feel yes. They know if they're comfortable in
the yes. Yes. This is Vayechazuba, and they felt there's the tug of the comfort of being in the exile, the joy of being in the exile. Okay, we go on to the next part, which is the beginning part of the book of Shemot. Let's have Adrian.
Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly, so that the land was filled with.
Okay, so then the Jewish people experience with their success, experience a tremendous population explosion. And not only that, it says that they became great. They also became mockers. They became distinguished. We're going to get that in a moment there. All right, and now, and then it says, and new king arose who did not know of Joseph, which of course is shocking because Joseph, a couple generations earlier, had rescued the entire Egyptian nation. How could you have a king who was completely ignorant of the basics of Egyptian history? Okay, many theories abound. We're going to take a look at the Sforno. Sforno, interesting character. Italian Jew. That's just cool enough. Just Italian Jew. That's it. That's just something. I don't have to say any more than that. No, he's also one of the first, what they call Rishonim. He got a PhD. Yes. Philosophy. They had dead philosophy, which meant different things back then, but he was just very well, and he also worked with the another court Jew, worked with the Christian leadership, and just a fascinating kind of guy, and wrote a commentary, and he says he wrote a commentary which is very short because his Jews in his thing are very successful and they don't give a lot of time for learning, so I create a short commentary in the entire Chumash because dealing with people that I don't got time for that, I'm making money. So he's but he was like it's 1500s, but it's like 2019. It's like it's just ridiculous. It's the same problem. So this is his theory of really the entire theory of the entire slavery. All right, let's have somebody read Jonathan Babakasha. Bottom Sforno. Yeah. Good.
After the last original 70 migrants had died,
their whole lifestyle
became more like that of creeping insects, creatures headed for destruction. This is why when a new.
All right, so what in order to, now how does he get that? Because the word by Yishritsu, the Sherosh of Yishritsu is Sheretz. Sheretz means a reptile. So that's a very not complimentary thing that in order. So Peru or Vu would be fruitful, multiply. That's complimentary. By Yishritsu, and it became. Numerous like a bug having reptile like fertility, not a compliment. You know, it's like somebody says, oh, you're having many babies as a rabbits. You know, I mean, that's negative.
Is it the same from voracious, the creepy crop?
Yes, exactly. Okay, so he picked up on that word by Yishritsu, and see, there's a criticism. That one word is an indictment on the a new Jewish community. We continue.
A new king arose over Egypt and did not know Joseph. Otherwise, when this happened, although there can be no question that in the annals of Egyptian history, 80-year reign of Joseph and his legislation saving Egypt from the famine was duly reported, as well as how he legislated that the whole land would belong to Pharaoh and the farmers would become his tenants, it did not occur to anyone who associated the Hebrews at the time. Time with Joseph, who had been so highly esteemed, they give the present day Hebrews deserve special consideration on account of their mischief. Their illustrious forebears did not occur to anyone observing the way these Hebrews behaved at that time.
So it's not that he did not know of Yosef, he did not associate Yosef with his generation. He's seen that they're like a low class. They're like they've become like a disgraceful people.
Why is he so harsh on them?
Well, he's
I think
he's inferring that because he's not saying he's explaining what the Sforno was explaining his theory of why the word Vayishvatu was used instead of just say Pruvu Muas Arts. Be fruitful, they were fruitful, and they multiplied, they filled up the land. They had to insert the word, and it became numerous as bugs. Is an indictment.
Is he the only one who interprets that word that way?
Yes.
What's the
Rashi thing? We're not doing all the ways. Methodologically, we're taking one. This is his read of the verse and his theory. But we're gonna let's unpack that one. There's obviously Rashi, Ramban, the other commentators have their own tack. But he has a very interesting theory. Why did the Egyptians feel no guilt?
Well, it's a very negative thing because in the Shemot it says, like, you know, the king did not remember Joseph. And I always thought, like, you know, it doesn't matter how high Jews rise in power, so be wary that the next day, you know, we world leaders can be fickle. We have to, like, look out for each other. And this word I was saying, like, oh, no, he knew Joseph. He didn't think these people, he didn't think that anything to do with him.
Right, Norris, so he's at Norris because
how is Stephanie posing this question? You're like the queen of like the fallen state of American Jewry, and like,
yeah, no, I'm just saying,
but so hard like, day of down like the fallen state of the Egyptian Jewry
because it's taking out the equation that maybe world leaders forget the good things Jews do, and so this lesson is not something that we ever learn.
First of all, those that does not contradict them, in other words, that actually reinforced them. In other words, how is it possible to forget all the good stuff? Is that they were Yosef and his brothers and his family were such a distinguished, elevated group, and then you have these people who seem like a bunch of, in his mind, a negative class. He allows him to disassociate himself that this group has anything to do with that group, and that allows him a justification, a rationalization. Why he's going to unleash, we're going to discuss next week, but his entire campaign against the Jews.
Is that because Joseph and his son did not do a good job?
So why didn't the Jewish people remain Yosef-like?
Yeah, was it the fault of Joseph? Is it just anti-Semitism and forgetting? And like, oh, we have all these strings in our country. I don't know how they got here. Get them out now. I mean, what is it?
I'm gonna bounce that question right back at you because
it's what I was saying. Because I got at least 10 more minutes. It's not that they forgot; it's that the actual behavior of the Jews changed.
Yes. Let's unpack that very carefully because it's extremely timely and relevant. What happened step by step? How did the Jews go from being these Yosef people who are basically tzaddikim to non-tzaddikim? And basically, complete integrated into Egyptian society, and sort of functioning as the lower class, not necessarily financially, but insofar as their refinement in behavior. How did that happen?
Well, I think it's the same thing that happened in Germany prior to the Holocaust, when the Jews began to assimilate into a culture.
Yep.
The native culture feels threatened because they're different, you know. So, in a sense, by staying apart, as Yosef and his siblings did, they don't create that sort of threat to the general populace. And once they started integrating into the cities and started taking off their costumes, well, then you got that sort of backlash, which just the same thing that happened in pre-Nazi Germany.
But in Germany, the Jews had leadership positions. Like, they were really high up in politics. They were, like, leaders.
Yeah, he said
thought leaders. So they weren't, like, low-class people
who
didn't behave.
But, no, in other words, he's not, you know, in other words, he, in other words, what Adrian's saying is, like, they become in Egypt. They become them, but they're like, in a certain sense, what they call, like, in the American vernacular, Egyptian wannabes. What's a wannabe?
It's a, not himself and not the person he's trying to be.
And therefore, how do people look at a wannabe? Okay, that's it. So the Jews come in, they're a separate community. They're led by the leadership of Yosef and his immediate descendants. They have a distinct and elevated community. Then they increase in size. The leadership is not there. They go, and so therefore, since there's no, you know, culture abhors a vacuum, they start taking up the culture of Egyptians. But they're the Egyptian wannabes who are competing to be more Egyptian than the Egyptian, which of course they're now competitor, which of course elicits what? Aggression.
So therefore that becomes
sort of like the background radiation, if you will, which sets the stage for Paro's campaign against the Jews, the enslavement, which is going to come next. We'll discuss that next week.
There's also no codification or cohesion of Jewish culture at this point. I mean, we're going from unique personalities, right, with the Avos, into a general culture. I mean, it's pre Sinai, so there's no revelation of it.
Yes.
So there's no unifying structure to instill any kind of.
Correct. In that situation, you need the leading personality, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef. Nobody.
Is it the failure?
That, by the way, is what Rashi talks about. Rashi focuses on that aspect. It says in the beginning of the Torah, the part of the in the story of Shemot, it mentions all of them by names. He says they're like stars; they can be identified individually. They're special. Then it says. Then it goes on to, and if Israel paru b'shutuva yirutuva yibatemli artotam, just a large mass of undifferentiated people, nothing special. And therefore, if you have a group of people there's lacking the leadership, a community, a society, the function of the leaders. If you have weak, poor leadership, the people go down. And now you're right. There's no revelation yet. So there's no Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef personality. So without that, so they're going to drift. Who becomes de facto the leader of the Jews? Aaron. Has to be. In America, now take it to America, 2019. American Jews. Who do they really view as their leaders?
Yeah.
Hey, what up? No. Whoever the leadership of America is. If they affiliate Democrat, it'll be Bernie Sanders. It'll be anybody from the Democrat Party, or Trump, whoever it is, or whoever the icons of America are, because they don't have their own sense of leader is. Or if you don't have a strong Jewish leader, it'll always go back to default into who's the leader of your whole community. 90% of American Jews are not observant, and most of those view themselves being just Jewish, nominally connected, and their identity is 100% American. They're Jewish American, but the essence is they're American. Versus, the classic says, are you an American Jew? Jew being your essence, the adjective being American, or are you a Jewish American? America is filled with Jewish Americans, very few American Jews.
Was there ever a question about having a chief rabbi in America?
Yes. Yeah. Glad you mentioned that. In the turn of the century, there was one, and it was terrible because they didn't want one. And basically, all of his efforts, because the Jews came over the 1880s, big 1880 to 1920, you had big immigration. Millions of Jews came, but the people who came were not really learned people. They're people who just were escaping brutality of the Tsar and poverty. They were talking about Europe where most of the Europe was 20 to 40% unemployment rate is grinding poverty. They're escaping. They're coming for economic reasons, not for spiritual renewal. So therefore, they looked at rabbis as leftovers of the old country, and were basically. It wasn't until, you know, post Holocaust that you had rabbis, maybe the 30s and 40s, rabbis who could represent America and Judaism in a way that was appealing. In this building, that's the creation of Rabbi Young, who was a rabbi for decades. Actually, rabbi, the founding rabbi, Mordechai Kaplan, who was Orthodox, ordained at Yeshiva University, and started another movement called Reconstruction of Judaism. And the congregation, the board, fired him because you are no longer an Orthodox rabbi. He says you're right, and he went down the street and started another synagogue. Yeah. Where Beit Rabban is, that's shul.
But
so
his concept of like the Jewish center of that was Mordechai Kaplan.
Yes, he was. You know, that was his idea. It's like in order to preserve Judaism for Jews to take Judaism seriously, they have to feel the certain elements of Americana. So we're going to be a shul with a pool. It was basically the Jewish center was a JCC with daily minyanim.
Yeah.
That was their chop. I was here when they had in the ninth floor the pool. And then, they took it out.
How did they take it out?
I don't know, 10 years ago, because it was no longer a roof. But there was a time, but it's crazy. You had that was spoke to American Jewry. So that was his idea of a Jewish community center, and where it's like American, but Jewish. Perfect. But that was his attempt to deal with the issue. So basically, let's go back to the title. The title of the class is The Perils of Jewish Success. Intrinsically, emancipation and freedom from oppression. Jews are our successful bunch. And we have the freedom, we become successful. And then we become integrated, and that causes a whole host of problems. We don't take an isolationist approach, which is not to engage, because you have to engage. You don't engage, you have no influence, and your brothers and your will get killed, like 6 million of them. Too much over-engagement or engagement for the right and wrong thing could be dangerous. I mean, I hope I'm not, hopefully I'm just giving a theoretical tale, but things are unraveling. We'll see how it goes, but it could go really bad. I'm just telling you right now, I don't want it to be that. It could go really bad because there's a lot of Jews in that administration. If the thing blows up, I'm not saying, you know, what that will be for America is one issue, and what will be for the Jews, it could go bad.
Well, I mean, you
should only be in power or run for elected office because you're the only person. If you don't do it, somebody else is going to do a worse job.
Correct.
Or a group of people saying, like, listen, you're the best person to do it. The other person is going to
Well, they make the case.
Bad.
Right. But it has to be a person who really is authentically does not
you
want
to know, like, if you don't do it, like, it's going to be bad forever.
Correct. And that's it. And now, again, it's to do this, to take position of elected office, then and certainly now, is basically the sacrifice of the rest of your whole life.
Queen Esther,
the most extreme example.
The Jews,
right. Correct. That's good.
Has there been any particularly good, like, well-regarded court Jews in the past 20 years? Anyone that's like, oh, there's an example.
There are many Jews that, I mean, in the last administration, Jack Lew, he was the Treasury Department. He was a good guy, functioned properly. I mean, but he was a good person for the job. He wasn't really fundamentally in a role to preserve Jewish. It was just a Jew doing a good job in an administration. Okay. This is a whole thing, but this is a topic. There are books on the court Jew. But I just want to give you guys a little taste. All right, guys, have a great night. Next week we go on to the enslavement.